Hello and welcome to Big Ideas on ABC Radio National. I'm Peter Mayers. Today we're locked on the horns of a dilemma, the growth dilemma. Economic growth has brought wonderful benefits to humanity, lifting millions of people out of poverty. But if we accept that we live in a finite world, then growth can't go on forever. In fact, it's already obvious that we're running up against global ecological limits. Yet we don't know how to run an economy that does not grow. The only alternative we seem to have is a shrinking economy, and that means recession, with all its destructive social consequences. So is it possible to have prosperity without growth? This is the question posed by Tim Jackson, Professor of Sustainable Development at the University of Surrey and Economics Commissioner at the UK Sustainable Development Commission. Professor Jackson presented one of this year's Deakin Lectures at Federation Square in Melbourne. Here he is, speaking to a capacity audience on the topic, Prosperity Without Growth.
What I'm going to do is three things, really, three chunks of lecture. The first chunk is around something which I call the dilemma of growth. And it's, in my mind, a serious dilemma. It's nothing trivial. It's something we have to take quite profoundly as the place where we are at the moment. If we fail to do that, it seems to me we won't be doing any justice to concepts of sustainability. So that's part one, and our response to that. What is our response to this thing I call the dilemma of growth? Part two is acknowledging, in fact, that our response to the dilemma of growth falls short in certain ways. I want to invite us to explore the dynamics of the economic and social system that is creating this dilemma. And again, this can be quite complex, it can be quite profound, but I'll try to paraphrase for you in a simple way, simple-ish way, exactly how I see that dilemma in very human terms. And then having established those dynamics and that dilemma, I want to talk about avenues for change, places where we could, in fact, do things differently, different kind of prosperity, a different kind of economic system, perhaps even a different kind of society. It's a journey that starts out with a very, very simple question. How can our economy continually expand on a finite planet? And it ends up, actually, with what I regard as an absolutely essential, but possibly quite philosophical, introspection about the nature of our society, and indeed about who we are as people. And I think it's worth actually trying to get that spectrum of from simplicity to depth into our conversations if we can. So I hope you will bear with me through those three parts. So let me start right at the top. I've already pitched, in a way, a part of my dilemma of growth. How is it possible for a continually expanding subsystem, let's call it the economy, of a finite system, let's call it the planet, to continue to deliver its system goals? Does it not carry within it, as indeed the Club of Rome suggested over 40 years ago, does it not carry within it the seeds of its own destruction at some level if it cannot square that circle of continuing expansion within finite limits? Or in terms of a very brutal horn of a dilemma, is it not the case that growth is simply unsustainable? At least the growth that we have at the moment is unsustainable, drawing as it does on material resources that are in finite supply, pushing against ecological limits that are clearly constraining activity, and indeed continuing to do that into the foreseeable future. That horn of the dilemma, that growth is unsustainable, was reinforced, I think, most profoundly, perhaps, by a report from the Stockholm Resilience Centre that came out at the end of last year that talked about where we are in relation to safe operating space, the planetary boundaries under which the economy has to operate. And they pointed out, actually, that the existing scale of economic activity is already in several key places beyond that safe operating space. Climate change is the most obvious example. They pointed to it quite clearly. But perhaps one of the most interesting things, in fact, is that climate change didn't appear as the single most important thing, the place where we were furthest past the operating space. That position was taken by biodiversity loss. Rates of extinction of species 50 times greater than pre-industrial background levels, and at least 10 times greater already than that team of scientists believe could be considered as a safe operating space. What's the key lesson? That at this level of economic activity, already we are outside planetary boundaries. We are in a condition of ecological overshoot. So how is it that we can consider an economy which, if it grows at the rates that it has done over the last 50 years, will be 16 times bigger by the year 2100, or 80 times bigger than it was just five decades ago? And even this 80 times bigger economy won't be a place which has delivered the poorest nations out of poverty and given them a hope, a chance of a Western level of income. If you wanted to achieve that bigger goal, the goal of global equity, you need an economy that is 200 times bigger than it was 50 years ago. The resource implications, the environmental implications of such an economy are barely believable, really, and yet this is the default supposition for the direction of our economy. So my simple first horn of the dilemma, that growth is unsustainable, seems to be, at least in terms of what we have had so far in our growth-based model, completely incontrovertible. It wouldn't be a dilemma, of course, if it didn't have another horn. So where does the other horn come from? Growth has delivered us good things. Let's start with that presupposition. It's improved life expectancy, it's improved health, it's improved education outcomes. It has delivered and clearly needs to continue delivering a better quality of life, particularly in the poorest nations. And there's a very interesting part of this analysis which asks, what do we see if we look at the data here? What do we see if we look at that relationship between growth and improved well-being, human well-being? And actually, we see a very interesting story. It's a story that income growth matters profoundly in the poorest nations, that every increment in income growth delivers big returns in terms of life expectancy, infant mortality, maternal morbidity, participation in education, life satisfaction, happiness. And as incomes increase, that relationship weakens. So that, in fact, by the time you get to the richest nations of the world, you see very little return, very little bang for the buck, if you like, between increasing incomes and human development outcomes. But what that does is it begs the question, how come we're still chasing growth in the richest nations in the world? How come this is our default model of economic progress in the developed nations of the world, in the richest places of the world? Why are we still addicted to growth? And this is a complex question, but it can be summarized very simply in the second horn of my dilemma. Let's do away with growth and let's have something instead. Let's call it degrowth. There is, in fact, a degrowth movement. It originated in France, where it is known by the much more savory term of décroissance. Almost sounds like something you'd want for breakfast. But there is a difficulty with décroissance and with degrowth, which is that under existing conditions, it's unstable. We don't know how to make economies work when they're not growing. In fact, we panic as soon as they show any signs of slowing down. And one of the basic dynamics behind this is the continual pursuit in capitalist economies of labor productivity. Let me just describe briefly how that goes. If you continually pursue labor productivity, you're doing more things with the same number of people each year. So next year, you can do the same amount you did this year with fewer people. So if your economy isn't growing, then essentially labor productivity is pushing people out of work. Here's a very simple dynamic. Continually pursuing labor productivity means doing more next year with fewer people and driving people out of work, unless what? Unless your economy is growing. Now, here is something that politicians understand, that growth equals jobs, that jobs equals votes, and any government that doesn't respond appropriately will find itself out of office. And here, I would submit, is a very real dilemma. This is not a trivial place to be. This is not a place where we have simple solutions. It's not a place where we can appeal to long-standing Greens, tell us how to make this new economy work. It is, in fact, a place, as the financial crisis has shown us, of profound discomfort and the need to engage, I would argue, strenuously with a very profound dilemma. Growth is unsustainable. Degrowth, at least as we know it, is unstable. So we have that dilemma. We've known about it in some form or another for quite a long time. What is the political response? What's the answer here? What is it that's on the table that will allow us to escape from such a dilemma? And it is a very, very simple idea. It's a little technological, but it basically is an appeal to technology. It's an appeal to something called decoupling. What does decoupling mean? It means essentially separating out, decoupling economic activity. We want our economies to be going up and up and up. Dollar value increases is a sign of the progress that we want, and it's essential for the stability of our economies. But suppose that we could do all of that economic activity more efficiently, suppose that we could dematerialize the content of that economic activity, suppose we could decarbonize it, then could we not decouple economic activity from material impacts, spread that wedge in such a way that we can get under the bar, that we can reach our ecological limits by doing things with fewer materials while still keeping our economy going? It's a very, very appealing idea. It's in fact an idea that has a lot of basis in our understandings of modern economies, because we prize the fact that we can do things more efficiently. And in fact, if we look at the data over the last two or three decades, we have done things more efficiently. At the global level, carbon intensity per dollar of economic activity has fallen by about a third over the last two to three decades. The trouble is, that's not enough. In the same breath that you do things more efficiently, you also do more of them. So you're in a continual struggle between efficiency and scale, between technology and output. And if you ask yourself the question historically, which of efficiency and scale has won the battle, the data are abundantly clear. It's absolutely obvious. Since 1990, even, carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel consumption have increased by 40%. Output, scale, outweighed efficiency. Even with all our clever technology and our efficiency built into the system, we did not achieve absolute reductions of any kind in carbon emissions. We went in the wrong direction. Now, it's a salutary point, and one of the responses to it could quite easily be, well, we just didn't try hard enough. There wasn't enough effort put into that. So the next question you have to ask yourself is this: how hard would we need to try in order to have, let's just do this as a thought exercise, a world in the middle of this century of 9 billion human beings, all aspiring to Western levels of income, all expecting those incomes to grow at 2% per annum? This is the growth-based model that we're testing here, and yet still achieving stabilization targets for carbon. It's a pretty simple thought exercise. We prize those things: global equity, the growth-based model, our ecological limits. How far and how fast would technology have to run to achieve these goals? I did a little scenario in the book, and the numbers work out something like this. You have to get the carbon intensity of economic activity down from an average of 770 grams of carbon per dollar, as it is at the moment, to less than 6 grams of carbon per dollar, a 130-fold reduction. Have we ever achieved anything like it? The answer is no, not by an order of magnitude. And then, of course, if the economy is still growing, then by the second half of the century, you actually need an economy that is taking carbon out of the atmosphere. The CO2 per dollar goes negative. A negative number means what? It means instead of pumping carbon into the atmosphere relentlessly, we have a society that's pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. And this is something, when you think about it just for a moment, you realize we have no idea what this economy looks like. We don't know what its resource base is, we don't know what its technology is, we don't know how its production is organized, we don't know what its products and services are, we don't know what life is like in such an economy. And yet this is the logical conclusion of a scenario that says, yes, we can grow indefinitely, we can achieve global equity, and we can meet our carbon targets. Now, it seems to me that unless we want to find ourselves trapped in a form of magical thinking, this is a point at which we need to ask ourselves quite seriously, can this economy, can this society really deliver us that kind of goal? Or should we be thinking more profoundly about the underlying structures?
This is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National, and you're listening to Professor Tim Jackson speaking at the recent Deakin Lecture Series in Melbourne on prosperity without growth. He's identified a key dilemma. Growth delivers desirable things, but it's unsustainable in a world of finite resources. And even if we make our economy much more energy efficient, even if we deploy the best technology conceivable, an economy based on growth will still outstrip its ecological limits. Tim Jackson now turns to the second chunk of his argument, his analysis of the economic structures that give rise to the growth dilemma. It's a discussion that leads to questions about our fundamental makeup, questions of psychology and human nature.
This can be a slightly scary place to be because it does draw on the importance of economics. I'm not here to overthrow economics. Rather, I'm here to say that our understanding of economic structure is vital. And yet, if we look closely at that understanding, we find ourselves in a very uncomfortable place. Let me quickly run through with you the dynamics of that and then summarize in a slightly populist way exactly what I think this means. It means primarily a system in which firms produce goods for households, that's us, people, and also provide us with incomes. That's fantastic because we can spend it on more goods and services. It's called the circular flow of the economy. I want to draw attention to something within that structure, though, that turns out to be critical. It's the role of investment. Investment plays a profound role in protecting our productive assets. It also plays a profound role in chasing labor productivity, the dynamic that I spoke of before that draws us into the need for growth. It does some good things in the process. For example, it brings down prices. But in bringing down prices, it encourages people to buy more stuff. And so it isn't just a circular flow. It begins to accelerate at least economic value through the system. It also accelerates resources. And to understand this fully, we need to look at another of the features of investment in the modern economy. Joseph Schumpeter pointed this out in the early 20th century. He spoke of a process called creative destruction. Creative destruction is the continual throwing over of old processes in favor of new ones, the continuing throwing over of old products in favor of new ones, the production of novelty, incentivized by the pursuit by the firm of expanding markets and achieving profits. And this production of novelty, this is where it gets even more fascinating in a sense. This production of novelty by firms, as it turns out, has a perfect counterpart in us, in people, in consumers. Because it turns out, this may just be an unhappy feature of the way that we're constructed as human beings, we can come back to that. It turns out we have something of an appetite for novelty. We love new stuff. The consumption of novelty and the production of novelty offer actually a twin dynamic locked together from the incentive of the firm to the incentive of us as human beings for novelty. And it's worth paying just a little bit of attention to that incentive within us, that dynamic within us, the consumption of novelty. Where does it come from? There's clearly a sense, and it's played out in lots of discussions in the sociology of consumption, that we're playing games through new stuff around our status as human beings. We signal with material goods. It's not just about functionality. It's about social signals. It's about telling stories. It's about a language of goods that speaks to other people, to other social groups, to our own social groups, and even to ourselves about identity, about status, about meaning. It's a place where we use consumer goods essentially to establish the fact, as Mary Douglas once beautifully put it, that we, as human beings, are helping to create the social world and find a credible place in it. It's a very humanizing vision, actually, of our role as consumers, and a very important one to take seriously. It's important to note, too, that it's not just novelty. It's not just status-seeking behaviors that novelty gives. Novelty brings us a sense of hope. It brings us a sense of a newer, brighter, shinier world, a place where things are better today than they were yesterday, and where they will be better tomorrow for our children than they were today. So the suggestion that I'm making to you is that there are elements within our social psychology that are actually driving and drawing us into this dynamic of growth. It is a real engine of growth, and it's not just growth of economic value. Because of this link between material things and social psychology, actually it becomes an engine of growth of material resources. It draws resources inexorably through it. It's a strange system in many ways. It's a system, for example, that runs on anxiety. The anxiety of the firm is that capital will fly elsewhere if we don't engage in creative destruction. The anxiety of us as people, very, very simple. Adam Smith talked about it nearly 200 years ago, the anxiety of living a life without shame. In Adam Smith's day, all that meant was a linen shirt, for the want of which we wouldn't be seen in public without shame. Today, of course, it's a huge basket of goods and commodities, and we will use that economic system continually to feed that desire, that anxiety for a life without shame. And we'll be encouraged to do so, for example, by the massive expansion of credit and debt. This is a point where this dynamic becomes incredibly useful in understanding how the financial crisis arose. Over a period of 15 to 20 years, a massive monetary expansion was used to fuel consumption growth in the real economy, quite deliberately so. The architects of monetary expansion were explicit about that goal. But the upshot was, in fact, and here's just some data from the UK, which is not atypical, but shouldn't be taken as the same across all countries, consumer debt rose dramatically over the 15 years prior to the crash until it was, for 3 years in a row, above the GDP in the UK. And at the same time, personal savings crashed. They absolutely plummeted until they were below zero. Net personal saving was below zero just before the crash. Statistics, you will tell me. What do they mean? Okay, here's my paraphrase of what this means in practice. It means something like this. Here is the story of those years and our consumer society. It's a story of us being encouraged persuaded perhaps, to spend money we don't have on things we don't need, to create impressions that won't last on people we don't care about. Or worse still, who don't care about us. Now, what was that about? When all we wanted to do, in fact, was to create a decent place for ourselves in the social world. It's a pathological system. It's a system which we can see our own psychology implicated in, and it's a system that demands that we intervene in it. Well, okay, I give you a choice here. You don't absolutely have to intervene in it. You could at this point say, and I'm often tempted to say it myself, this is too difficult. This is a stacked deck of cards. It wasn't dealt evenly. There's no escape from this mix of economic structure and human psychology. I am going to find myself a small patch of land on a hillside somewhere, above the rising sea level, obviously. And I'm going to spend the rest of my energy living in harmony with nature. Some vegetables, a few goats, a couple of chickens, and I'll spend my time in nice artistic endeavor with my friends and family occasionally, not too many of them, because that may not sustain a big community. And actually, as your thought train goes towards how many acres of land we would need for these 9 billion people, actually you're tempted to believe perhaps you should take some armaments with you to this hillside retreat. Kalashnikov, AK-47, recommended armament of choice in these circumstances. And you very quickly begin to realize, actually, this lifeboat strategy is not a very good one. There will be people clambering, barbarians at the gate, when actually the system goes down. And increasingly, you find yourself drawn back, in fact, to saying, what can we do? What can we do now? Is this really as impossible as it looks? And this, really, in the last few minutes, is the third part of the argument in Prosperity Without Growth. It says in simple terms that as you look at each of these impossibility theorems, as you ask yourself, well, do economies really have to be like that? Do politicians really have to respond like that? Is this really who I am as a human being? In fact, that deeper questioning, in every case, it seems to me, reveals that these impossibility theorems are not what they claim to be, that there are avenues of change, and that it is a responsibility on us, really, to explore those avenues of change. Very, very quickly, let me summarize a couple of things from that. The first, of course, is can we make sense of prosperity that isn't about rising incomes? And actually, it doesn't take you very long. Anyone with any knowledge of the literature, of philosophy, of social psychology, of economic history, of wisdom traditions, actually just asking people in the street tells you that prosperity does have a meaningful sense that isn't directly about income growth. What is it about? It's about the health of our families, it's about the trust of our friends, it's about the security of our communities, it's about participation in the life of society, it's about some sense, perhaps, of having a meaningful life and a hope for the future. And actually, that hope for the future really matters. It matters that the vision of hope that we have given our children is no longer robust in the face of the constraints of the world, and we desperately need, in fact, to bring ourselves back, to bring our eyes back to a more robust sense of a real prosperity. I like the idea, it simply convenes that sense, if you like, that prosperity is about our ability to flourish as human beings within the ecological limits of a finite planet. And the limits question to me does a very profound thing. It says to me that my prosperity hangs on those, on the prosperity of those around me as theirs does on mine. That it is, in fact, only meaningful to think of prosperity as a shared prosperity, and indeed as a lasting prosperity. to chase a vision of prosperity based on short-term returns actually is to give away the concept of prosperity. We still need material goods, that's absolutely clear. But what could we do? Could we do anything about the concepts of participation in society, about the importance of social and psychological flourishing? And again, as soon as you ask yourself this question, the answer leaps back at you, yes. One very simple idea, it's not by any means the only one, you don't even have to accept that it is the most important one, but my job here really is to say, could we think differently about social and psychological flourishing? Could we think differently about participation in society? And immediately, actually, what comes back at you is yes. If participation is what matters, then are we thinking appropriately about public space, about the way we interact with each other as human beings? Are we thinking about what's happening to public space? Michael Sandel, in a Reith lecture last year, talked about public space as sites for the cultivation of a common citizenship. Is there not an idea here, the revision, the rebuilding of public space and of social goods that brings us back towards that notion of shared prosperity? I would submit that there is, and that that is one of many good starting points for thinking about a different prosperity. I can't evade the question, of course, of the economy itself. What can we say about the impossibility theorem that economies have to work like this? I'll just point very briefly to what I see as a key role in that exploration. And if you recall my discussion of the role of investment chasing high return, short payback, productive assets that expand consumer markets as the model of investment in the old economy, the model of investment in the new economy has to be radically different. I talk about a concept of ecological investment. I talk about targets for that investment in low carbon transition, in the protection of ecological assets, in the maintenance of social goods. Investing, in other words, in the idea that our society has some kind of future. This role for investment is absolutely vital. Investment, at the end of the day, is a relationship. The fundamental economic relationship between the present and the future. It's a place that we have to explore the role for another kind of investment very seriously. And that will mean, yes, examining public funding, the role of the state. It will mean examining the structure and integrity of financial markets. But for goodness sake, if we're not looking at the structure and integrity of financial markets when the public purse has bailed out the financial sector to the tune of $7 trillion and almost saw the collapse of the entire system, then when are we ever going to do it? This is a time for reflection. It's a time for deep reflection. My last, very last philosophical point about our nature as human beings. Am I asking humanity to change its nature? Am I saying we've got to change the course of evolution here? Isn't it the case that we are all, in fact, these consumers deeply implicated in this expanding material economy? And here, it seems to me, the message of hope is the strongest of all, because there is no evidence in social psychology that we really are the narrow, materialistic, selfish, individualist consumers that the economy would have us believe that we are. Social psychology talks much more about tensions between selfish and other regarding behaviors. It talks about tensions between novelty seeking and conservation and tradition. All of these poles of the tensions matter. They mattered in evolutionary terms. We evolved as much as social beings as we did as individual beings. We evolved as much in laying down the foundations for a stable society as we did in continually pursuing novelty. But what we've done in the consumer economy is to favor, to privilege, to preference novelty-seeking, selfish behaviors, because that's what we need to keep this system going. And my argument, far from saying that we have to change human nature, is broadly this. We have to free our imagination. In fact, to think of ourselves, perhaps for the first time in 200 years, as full, complete human beings, with those tensions, with those poles, with our concern for others, with our care for the environment. It's a place, in fact, in which it's possible once again to be creative as human beings. This is not just a place for creative thought, it's a place for responsibility to create a prosperity that is worthy of the name and that returns to our children an idea of hope for the future. Thank you very much.
Tim Jackson, author of Prosperity Without Growth and Professor of Sustainable Development at the University of Surrey in the United Kingdom, delivering a Deakin Lecture at Federation Square in Melbourne last month. This is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National. I'm Peter Mayers. After his lecture, Professor Jackson took questions from the audience.
My name's Phil. I'm from Geelong. My question, Tim, is about the Transition Town movement. For those who don't know, it's a movement about recognising that our sustainable future is based on relocalising our food and reconnecting communities with the source of their well-being. What role do you see the transition movement having? Now that it is a worldwide phenomenon, what role do you think they have in bringing about prosperity without growth?
I think they have a very important role. Actually, the Transition Town movement is one example of numerous attempts, really, to live more sustainably, to work more sustainably, to build communities that are more resilient. And my research group, actually, at the University of Surrey, has spent quite a lot of time exploring those kinds of local community-based initiatives, and there are very clear findings. People in these communities create very different narratives about meaning in their lives. They hold very different and often much stronger environmental values, and they even sometimes have lower footprints. There's a difficult message, though, which is that quite often the overriding sense in these communities is one of struggle, because in the process of creating change at the community level, inevitably you come up against bigger structures, structures that actually do require intervention at policy level, at government level, at bigger level. The intervention has to reach into the business community. So I see these as incredibly important initiatives, but the biggest message for me from what's happening so far is how much needs to be done at policy level to allow these initiatives to flourish.
My name is Richard Yanieri. I'm from Melbourne. Look, I haven't read your book, and I apologize for my ignorance of your background. I'm not sure if you are in liberal arts or sciences. My question is in relation to the application of your philosophy, your tenets, in terms of stability of economy. Has there been any modeling done to see what we can do to look at stability?
Yep, that's a very important question.
Thank you.
I apologize for you not being able to tell which discipline I come from. It is a slightly eclectic background. I'm a mathematician, actually, by original discipline, but as Kenneth Boulding once said, mathematics brought the rigor to economics, but it also brought the mortis. So I'm always wary of saying that economic modeling will get us out of the problem, but I absolutely agree with your fundamental point that we need something which will point us the way. How are we going to create an idea of a stable macroeconomy that doesn't rely on increasing consumption growth? This is, and I point to this very clearly in the book, I identify a few initiatives, and there are remarkably few of them, which have attempted to address this question. We do not have a fully founded, fully functional macroeconomics of sustainability, and we desperately, desperately need one. I would like a small corner of treasury, anywhere, given over not to the conventional fiscal balancing of the growth-based economy, but exploring our options. It's just precaution. It's common basic sense to engage in that. And there's a call for that in the book. There's suggestions, the avenues that it will take us, and there's some examples of pioneers in that field.
Bruce McNeil. In Victoria, there is a requirement for at least 5,000 new jobs to be created per month in order to maintain the current employment level, number one. Number two, growth corridors which are developing in Sydney have to introduce infrastructure which includes hospitals, transport, blah, 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 all the rest of it. And those growth corridors are happening at a fairly alarming rate in Australia. How do you conceive that there might be some way of engaging in a kind of limiting process for those kind of expectations, I suppose?
Yep, it is a really important question. The one thing that I would have to say, and I hope I said before, but maybe not quite strongly enough, is that jobs matter. Meaningful participation in society matters, and paid employment is one of the ways in which we achieve that. Now, there are radical ways to think about restructuring work, and those kinds of calls for a different sense of the relationship between paid employment and unpaid employment, the value of unpaid labor, engaging people in society in meaningful ways, are all very important things to think about. But the fundamental question that you're asking, which is on the politician's mind, is how do we square this relationship between jobs and growth? And there are basically only two ways of doing this. In the arithmetic that I sketched out to you, which was of an increasing labor productivity, can only employ people for as long as the economy grows, that difficult dynamic. And the two ways out of that dilemma are, firstly, to say, perhaps what we should be doing is accepting the labor productivity gains and working less. This would require sharing available work, and you'd need work time policies to create that. But actually, this avenue is really interesting because it was the thoughts of some of the early fathers of macroeconomics. Keynes himself, for example, saw the chasing of labor productivity as a process that would ultimately lead to a place where our economic needs of the first kind, as he described them, were broadly met, and that we could give over our lives to the more meaningful aspects of participation of our family, our friends, and our quality of life outside the market. And that's a very interesting place to think about development. What it does do, though, is it places an onus on schemes that provide flexibility in jobs, schemes that allow jobs work to be shared, schemes that cut down the sector of the population which increasingly works too hard and has no leisure time, and builds up those parts of the economy where more flexible time, more part-time work, and more sharing of the resources of paid employment is available. There is, though, another really interesting response to this is, what do I need to accept this labor productivity dynamic? Is this really the direction that the economy is going to go on forever and ever, doing more with fewer people? Does it make sense, for example, in a service-based economy, to have my doctor seeing 1,000 more patients next year than she saw this year, to have my yoga teacher having more people crammed into her village hall to give her yoga classes, to have leisure and recreation consistently oversubscribed just so that we can chase labor productivity? It seems to me, and in fact, again, there's economic precedent for this, that there's a very useful exploration of productivity itself. Does it make sense to chase labor out of jobs where it's the human labor input that provides the quality of that work? Or should we be supporting, in fact, exactly those sectors of the economy which bring people into a form of paid employment that contributes to human flourishing? And my argument, of course, is that we should open up that possibility, that we should explore both of those avenues. But it is a very important question.
My name is Aruna Senavaratne. You paint novelty and growth almost as a bad thing, but I don't want to drive a 50-year-old car, and it may not even make the best use of resources to do so. If we can get the value of resources correct, including the atmosphere, can't we crave all the novelty and growth that we want?
Novelty, is it always bad? No, and I don't think that's what I'm saying. It's true to some extent that I demonized it, but just as a point of very personal reflection, if you like, my son was born with a hole in the heart, which as a parent, a new parent, was absolutely terrifying, because it was picked up by a diagnostic at a six-week check, and we were told quite early on that this little perfect human being had to have his chest bust open and his heart tinkered with because of an ailment that we couldn't even see. And my sense of going through that process actually is that technological progress really does matter, that we have done incredibly important things that deliver real health benefits, real outcomes in terms of, for example, my son's longevity. He would have had the expectation of maybe 25 years of life, with the last 5 years being incredibly painful. But because of a small piece of Gore-Tex and the ability of a very careful and skilled surgeon to open up a baby's heart and stitch the Gore-Tex into it, he now virtually has the same life expectancy as anyone else. So to me, the message of this is that technological progress matters and that novelty matters too. What I am trying to offset, I think, and to me this story of my son, you know, pushes me even harder towards this, is where does that stack up against increasing gadgetry, increasing junk, novelty for its own sake, novelty for the sake of status consumption that is at best a zero-sum game? Is that pursuit of novelty that I'm demonizing, if you like, and saying actually what we need desperately is to keep the creativity of the human spirit, the creativity of human endeavor, in order to deliver meaningful ways to improve our quality of life and those of our children? And that's my call, rather than simply saying, let's do away with novelty.
Thank you. Gordon's my name. My question relates to the value of distributed systems and what contribution they can make to this dilemma.
Distribution, does it matter? Absolutely, profoundly, yes. Actually, and again, this doesn't always come across as clearly as I would like it to do when I frame the debate, but it was there in my implicit question about where growth matters. It matters where it improves the livelihoods of the poor, and it matters in real terms of human development in outcomes, measurable outcomes in those areas. And so this debate doesn't make sense outside of the question of distribution of incomes, distribution of access to work, distribution of access to ecological space, distribution of access to quality of life. It's absolutely critical to the agenda. This agenda, prosperity without growth, is in some ways, you could recast it as making room for growth where growth matters. You could say actually this is a redistributive agenda. It is about recognizing that in the context of finite limits, we cannot grow the absolute pie. We have to think about who has what and about that concept of shared prosperity.
My name's Patricia Geraghty. How do we factor in human population growth?
So population growth matters, absolutely. Two things scale total output. One is the level of affluence and the other is the level of population. Very interesting dynamics, though. If you look over the last 50 years, you find that they've been about equal, population growth and affluence growth, in scaling, for example, carbon emissions, about equal over 50 years, but over the last 15 to 20 years, the affluence factor dominates over population. It's become more important than population growth. And as demographic change takes place, we can expect that dynamic to increase. In other words, that we have to look very, very carefully at affluence growth itself. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't look at population. And this is one of the places, actually, where my argument about making room for growth has some positive feedback, because one of the things that happens through demographic transition is that you reduce unwanted pregnancy, that you reduce fertility rates in the poorest nations. And in fact, you move us to a place by sharing growth, by sharing the prospects of growth with poorer nations, to a place which also addresses the population question. It's a partial answer to a very, very tricky question, but a very important one.
My name's Ron. I have a very simple question. Do you think we should do something about advertising? It seems to me that we get a lot of our values from advertising, that our... We're being encouraged to be anxious and to alleviate that anxiety by buying high-status goods and all that nonsense. Now, you can develop wisdom, or do you think there should be some form of censorship on advertising, which will give us a measure of move yeah. our values in the right direction?
Advertising is clearly plays a role in that fetishization of novelty, and I think, to me, it's absolutely clear that advertising is one of the places that one should intervene. There is a whole spectrum of political interventions, and it seems absolutely clear to me that advertising, which has perverse social outcomes and is a tax-deductible interim expenditure, which is incentivized within the system and creating all sorts of zero-sum games, is a legitimate place to question what we're doing in creating the signals for a consumer society. In my view, we have to broaden it out. We have to say, we have to talk about media standards, about trading standards, about trade policy. We have to talk about culture and the way that we perpetuate culture. We have to talk about the performance signals that governments send out to people to continually to be consumers. In the face of a recession, the ubiquitous call for everyone everywhere to go out shopping at the very point in time in which every sensible person wants to save their income and look to future security. No, the system demands that we go out and spend. John Maynard Keynes called it the paradox of thrift. I call it the perverseness of economics, freakonomics, the place where economics actually is driving us in perverse directions. And there's grounds for looking at all of these things. I don't want to stand here and say to you that that massive technological challenge of 130-fold reduction in carbon intensity, an economy that's pulling carbon out of the atmosphere rather than pushing into it, is an impossibility. I'm not going to stand here and say we couldn't absolutely create that challenge. But it seems to me we do have a real responsibility now to ask serious questions about our likelihood to achieve that, particularly if we're trying to achieve it without looking at the underlying structure. To me, it is no longer credible that we can think of this growth-based dynamic with its social logic of consumerism as a place where it's possible to deliver anything other than more of the same, more material aspiration, increasingly unsustainable throughput, and no progress at all towards carbon targets or protection of biodiversity. So at the very least, let's be honest enough. Let's have enough political honesty to have this conversation. Prosperity without growth, at the end of the day, was an invitation to a conversation. It was an attempt to say, let's just have a little bit of space here to reflect, to step back, to have a corner of treasury, to have places where, at last, it's possible and legitimate to put this question on the table, because it could turn out to be, in fact, the most important question of our times.
Tim Jackson, answering audience questions at his Deakin Lecture at Federation Square in Melbourne last month. And as you heard, he began his academic career as a mathematician, but he's also a playwright. In between his academic and policy work, he's found time to pen a number of award-winning radio plays for the BBC, a truly well-rounded intellect. Tim Jackson is a professor in the Centre for Environmental Strategy at the University of Surrey and Economics Commissioner at the UK Sustainable Development Commission, where he completed the 2009 report, Prosperity Without Growth? The report has recently been revised and published as a book by EarthScan. You'll find more information and relevant links on the Big Ideas website at abc.net.au/rn/bigideas, where you can hit the Add Your Comment tag on this story to give us your thoughts on Tim Jackson's ideas. And while he was in Australia for the Deakin Lectures, I also quizzed Tim Jackson at length about the ideas in his presentation. You can hear that interview on the next edition of The National Interest. The National Interest, of course, Fridays after the news at 6, after 4 in the West, or Sundays at midday. I'm Peter Mayers. I hope you can join me then. Now on ABC Radio National, it's coming up to news time.
Hi there, Geraldine Doogue here. I've been in the stunning city of Shanghai, collecting all sorts of gems from Chinese residents and some of the many Australian expats who call it home now. And why not? It's a city where you glimpse the future. Now, you might have missed our original broadcast, so catch it all online. Look for Saturday Extra on the Radio National homepage or listen every Saturday morning from 7:30.